Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
Typically, we do a series over a month and a half or 2 months or three or longer than that, but this one is particularly short. It's called W is for Welcome. And so the idea with what we're going to be doing today and over the next couple of weeks is we're going to bring the car in for a bit of a tune-up. We enjoy the fact that we are a welcoming community. We think we are a welcoming community, but we believe there's a lot more for us to explore in that way. And so today we're going to look at some biblical examples of welcome in God's character and in his people. And then the following 2 weeks after that, we're going to look at some real practical ways how today we might actually be able to look at where we are as a church right now and address maybe how we're going to grow, how we're going to continue to be a welcoming people and a people of invitation. So we're going to really get practical in the next couple of weeks. But today we're going to take a bit of a walk through the Bible. In the middle of and the emerging part of the Industrial Revolution, there were several British writers who used a really incredible, brilliant narrative to highlight some of the injustice and the poverty and the brokenness that they saw around them. And so they used their giftings, they used their pen to highlight it and to draw attention to it, especially when it came to children. This was a serious issue for them. And actually, some of our most famous stories, some of our most favorite stories, our time and critically honored narratives emerge from that time period, from some of these famous writers. One of the things that you will learn about me if you get to know me better is that I cry quite a bit at times that are often awkward. I don't usually cry if someone's mean to me. I'm embarrassed by something. It's not usually a social occasion, but I usually cry if something moves me. So if it's a piece of music, or it's a television show, or a commercial, to be honest with you. Like, is there any other people in the room where every now and then it's a commercial, and you feel a little bit ashamed of yourself that the advertisers were that good at what they do, they actually made you cry? So I don't like full on kind of blub, but I would say that I get misty, which sounds like the most unmasculine word ever invented. But I do feel that at times. One of the stories, no matter how it's told, whether I'm reading it or I'm watching it through the many reenactments over time that have been done on it, one of the stories that evokes just incredibly deep emotion and sentiment for me, and one of those stories that was written in that time period, is Peter Pan. The themes of Peter Pan are adventure and their sort of never-ending youth there in there. But perhaps the most important theme in Peter Pan, the one that really sticks, and I think the one that really carries the story and why we continue to be interested in it throughout history, is the theme of belonging. The theme of belonging. It's incredibly moving to unpack this story where we find a group of children actually called the Lost Boys who create for themselves an imaginary place where they can actually find community, family, togetherness, and welcome. And then another family that are made up of orphans and the poor, the darling children who have a family, but their family is actually not what they would hope it would be, end up finding community with these other lost boys, and they create their own family. They sit around their own tables and they have their own adventures as family they believe it's supposed to look like in their imaginations. And J.M. Barrie takes us on that journey, this theme of belonging. And you might find that the more you investigate the stories that we tend to celebrate, that the theme of belonging is at the core of many of them, the core of many of these famous stories. And many have noticed that the theme of belonging or family or acceptance elicits such a response from us, not simply because it pulls at our heartstrings, but because it's awakening something in us that's deeply human. It's tapping into something that's undeniably true about us. It really is more than just sentiment. It's more than just the heartstrings being pulled. So when we discover through any story, any narrative, any experience that there's room for us at a table with a group of people that care about us and love us, we gravitate towards it because it's a deeply embedded part of us to need to belong. And this is why I cry at Peter Pan, or a part of probably why that connects for me. At the very end of Jesus' life, he spends his last few hours with his closest friends, and they have a meal together. Jesus chooses the meal, a particular meal, to illustrate what's going to be happening over the next couple of days. He chooses this meal that's deeply connected to their culture, deeply connected to their understanding of how God saves and redeems, and he says that this kind of thing is going to be happening for all mankind over the next couple of days. And so he uses this meal. He retells this story and then says, you know, in a way, look up for how this is going to be occurring right here in front of you. And so this story and the actions over the next couple of days paralleled for Jesus, and he uses the meal to explain it. And the disciples, as usual, don't always catch on super, super quick. So the meal had like a lot of significance. It absolutely had tons of cultural and religious significance. But it was also just a meal. It was also just a meal. And for them, in their culture, this meant friendship. This meant togetherness. This meant trust. And something as simple as belonging. Something happens at the meal. It gets quite awkward early on. Jesus had a real knack of making meals quite awkward. It's something he was really good at. Not something we would highlight as one of his main giftings, but it was actually true about who he was. He made meals awkward all of the time. At one point, Jesus takes off some of his clothing and he prepares to work. And he begins to wash his friends' feet. It's hard to overstate how uncomfortable and how even disturbing this would have been for his friends and his disciples. It was bizarre culturally, it was shocking, and it was even offensive to some people like Peter, who at first resisted. A slave should have been at the door. Culturally, the lowest of the low in the household would be allotted to wash the feet of the house guests as they come in. They wore sandals, their feet got dirty and filthy, and so a washing of the feet was at part a religious ceremony, but it was also just a practical thing. The reality was that people's feet smelled and got dusty, so let's make it a little less smelly and dusty in the room and have our feet washed. When there wasn't someone to do that, Jesus seizes the opportunity to sear into the minds of his disciples the nature and the heart of God towards humanity. So Jesus is the perfect host. He's the most welcoming patron. And no act of welcome or love is below him. And he's about to prove this on the cross in service to the Father and because of his love for us. But he also proves it in the moment around the table with his friends. After doing so in John 13, he says this. After washing their feet, he put on his robe again and he sat down and asked, "Do you understand what I was doing? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, because that's what I am. And since I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. I have given an example for you to follow. Do as I have done to you. I tell you the truth. Slaves are not greater than their master, nor is a messenger more important than the one who sends the message. Now that you know these things, God will bless you for doing them." Throughout the course of the meal, he also says things like, "I've called you friends," or "love one another as I have loved you," or "there is no greater love than to lay one's life down for his friends," which is what he was about to do. So when it comes to love and care and welcome, Jesus means business, even towards the very end of his life. He means business. And Jesus is like this because God is like this. And God's always been like this from the very beginning. So let's talk a little bit about that. We discover when we open the Bible, the very first pages, that we see that God's nature is to love and to welcome. It's in God's nature to cultivate habitable space for humankind. Not simply in the abstract or philosophically does God welcome, but literally, it's who he is. And the first couple of characteristics that we learn about God is that first, he's an artist, an architect, he's a creator, he's an artist, but in, he also is a host. That's the other thing. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He creates the universe, and to our knowledge, at this point in time, at least in this solar system, he creates just one planet to be able to live on, to be able to breathe on, to not float off into space on, to not be seared by the sun by. He creates one place for us to live. This is our habitat, and it's a good one, and he intends for it to stay that way. One of the first things we learn about God is that he's a host, that he's created an environment for us to thrive in, and it's in his nature. And if you want to skip to the end of the book, you'll see that he continues to be that way. It's one of the last things we learn about him as well. So history rolls on. Humans progress post-creation. We form family units. We find safety in social structure, in community. We create food and eating rituals. And we learn to value trust. We learn to deeply value trust. We treat it as a precious commodity amongst ourselves, possibly more precious than anything else. We're not perfect, and we've proved that over the years, but something about togetherness and invitation and hospitality sticks with us. It's embedded somewhere. So through the story of God and humanity, we learn that God continues to take care of his people. He provides and promises future care for Abraham and for his descendants. And when Israel is captive in Egypt and cries out, God rescues and brings emancipation for a whole nation. He takes them on the road then, and he provides for them in various fashions, a movable feast. And though Israel continually abandons the lifeline that God extends to them, he sticks with them. They learn hard lessons, but he is faithful to them, and he's faithful in providing for them. As he teaches them to be this way, he says simply, be like me. He gives Israel a taste of his character through the giving of the law, and within it, specific mention concerning how they are to be like him and how they are to express some of his characteristics through their own lives. Leviticus 19, we have an example of that. Do not take advantage of foreigners who live among you in your land. Treat them like native-born Israelites and love them as you love yourself. Remember that you were once foreigners living in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So God hopes that his people will be full of grace and mercy for each other as he has been towards them. He expects them to take care of each other and even take care of those who can't take care of themselves. And we see this in the law. We heard it referenced this morning from Tanya, speaking of care for the widow and the orphan, the poor, the imprisoned, and so on. So through the scriptures, we continually see God's character revealed as welcoming and hospitable. This is the overarching posture of God towards humanity. David, who spends much of his time on the run for his life, vast amounts of time on the run for his life, understands God to be a person of safety and provision. In Psalm 23 that many of us know, he says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." In the middle of the fear, in the middle of the strife, in the middle of the chaos of my life, God, you provide for me a place where I can feel safe, a place where I can feel comfort, a place where I can be nourished right in the middle of all of it. You are there providing for me in that way. We hear the same thoughts expressed in Psalm 61. Solomon, David's son, sees God in a similar way. He writes in the Proverbs, "The name of the Lord is a strong tower that the righteous can run into and are safe." Safe. Again and again and again, God is seen this way. And we get the picture that when it comes to relationship with God, there's always room at the table. There's always room at the table. Let's talk about the grudge match of the century that everyone's talking about, Jesus versus Martha Stewart. So Jesus being like the fullest and best expression of God, right? Jesus is the fullest, best expression of God in his nature. Jesus enters on the scene. And he doesn't buy a big house, and he doesn't personally throw lots of dinner parties, unless you do want to count the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000, which we probably should. But he does attend a lot of dinner parties. He does show up to a lot. He does receive invitation, and he goes. And he doesn't seem to mind who he eats with. One day he's eating with wealthy types, and the next he's eating with nasty, mean, hated people. And he's actually out and about so much that some people call him a bit of a partier. They say, you're eating too much and you're drinking too much. And he gets a bad rap for that. But you'll notice that when Jesus comes to dinner, he usually has good reason. Not simply to welcome in the likes of Zacchaeus and other outsiders and welcome them into the kingdom of God, but he also goes to dinner at certain places and he decides to make a point when he shows up. In Luke 14, Jesus gets invited over to a rich religious person's house for dinner. And one writer describes it as one of the most awkward dinner parties of all time. That's his use for it. Because Jesus keeps picking fights and he keeps pointing out how the dinner party wasn't a very good dinner party at all, according to him. So Jesus and your mother-in-law might be on the same footing in that regard. But in Luke 14, the story goes this way. When Jesus noticed that all who had come to the dinner were trying to sit in the seats of honor near the head of the table, he gave them this advice. When you are invited to a wedding feast, don't sit in the seat of honor. What if someone who is more distinguished than you has been invited? The host will come and say, give this person your seat. And then you will be embarrassed and you will have to take whatever seat is left at the foot of the table. Instead, take the lowest place at the foot of the table. Then when your host sees you, he will come and say, friend, we have a better place for you. Then you will be honored in front of all the other guests. And this is the point, or one of the points, he's really trying to make. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. He's saying this to everybody at the table. It's starting to get awkward. And then he gets narrow, and he turns to the host, the person that's invited him, the person who's thrown the feast. It's probably a pretty good one. Then he turned to his host, verse 12. When you put on a luncheon or a banquet, he said, don't invite your friends, brothers, relatives, and rich neighbors, for they will invite you back. And that will be your only reward. Instead, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Then at the resurrection of the righteous, God will reward you for inviting those who could not repay you. Hearing this, a man sitting at the table with Jesus exclaimed, what a blessing it will be to attend a banquet in the kingdom of God. Not always sure why he's saying that, but maybe there's part of it is he's kind of diverting attention away from the awkwardness of the moment. But one writer points out that this isn't enough for Jesus. He continues to keep going. He doesn't change the subject. He doesn't make things comfortable. Jesus replied with this story in verse 16. A man prepared a great feast and sent out many invitations. When the banquet was ready, he sent out his servants to tell the guests, come, the banquet is ready. But they all began to make excuses. One said, I've just bought a field and I must inspect it. Please excuse me. Another said, I have just bought 5 pairs of oxen and I want to try them out. Please excuse me. Another said, I now have a wife, and so I can't come. That's not fair. Why are you? So ladies, if a guy ever asks you out, and you just don't want to do it, I just got some ox, I got to go try them out before we, you know, it might be work better than the hair washing thing. I don't know. Verse 21, the servant returned and told his master what they had said, and his master was furious and said, go quickly into the streets and the alleys of the town and invite the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame. After the servant had done this, he reported, there's still room for more. So his master said, go out into the country lanes and behind the hedges and urge anyone you find to come so that the house will be full. For none of those I first invited will even get the smallest taste of my banquet. It's not enough for Jesus to bring some of the marginalized people. He goes, go and find some of the criminals. Go and find some of the people that definitely nobody wants to trust in their house and bring them in here. This is the story that he tells about this master. Another writer says this about the passage that we've just read. Jesus' understanding of who are the downtrodden has been well expanded beyond the Old Testament understanding to include not just the victims of social structures and practices, widows, orphans, aliens, the poor, imprisoned, but also those excluded from full participation in society because they are defective, malformed, or seen as religiously inferior. The coming of God's just reign requires that these people be lifted up too. Or we might say, these people must also be welcomed. Jesus enjoys the company of all kinds. The disciples were questionable from the start, lots of unlikely choices there. And he's first to make really any kind of historical stand when it comes to women's or civil rights. He surrounds himself with scoundrels and the poor and the sick, and he seeks out the lonely, the isolated, the ostracized people in society. He's always ready to respond to them. His last conversation, his very last conversation before he dies with another human being is when he's on the cross speaking to the thief next to him. And he says, you know what? Forget about all the stuff that's gone on in your past life. Today, I'm going to take you past the bouncer and you're coming into the VIP room with me. Constantly, constantly, constantly welcoming. In fact, the only people whose company Jesus doesn't seem to enjoy are the exclusive, elite, cliquey bunch perched on top of the religious, cultural, or social food chain. After he rises from the dead, he continues to welcome and invite. He cooks literal breakfast on the beach for a group of men who took off on him at his worst hour in his entire life, who abandoned him. And they've been out fishing all night and they've caught nothing. And Jesus welcomes them in. And they have an interaction where some incredibly deep things happen in that last couple chapters of John. Peter is restored. Discussion about what the future will be occurs. But Jesus also simply makes for them a meal. He makes for them something comforting and beautiful in a moment when they've been out all night in the dark, possibly cold and wet, and here's a meal for you. Chef Jesus, as simple as that. This is the resurrected Jesus. This is the gloriously resurrected Jesus. This is the Jesus whose most recent accomplishments were conquering death and the grave. And apparently it wasn't beneath him to cook a meal like that. So as far as I'm concerned, I think Jesus should be on the cover of every Canadian Living magazine from now until the end of time. Jesus is like this because God is like this, and he's always been this way, and he's always going to continue to be this way. And you can't read about Jesus and miss the fact that he welcomed people, all kinds of people, in all kinds of places, at any time of the day or the week, even in his very last hour. And his followers, his first friends, get that. They grasp that. So God has welcomed humanity, God has pursued and invited humanity from creation to foot washing to the most generous act of all time, the cross. God's character has benefited us. We are the broken, right? We are the disenfranchised. We are the losers made winners. We are the outsiders made insiders. So mission accomplished for God. Sort of. Sort of. It never entered into the minds of Jesus' first followers that the grace and life that they'd encountered was meant to stop with them. It never entered their minds. They understood, and it showed by how they lived, that there was more room at the table. And Jesus expected them to help him fill it. The hospitable and invitational nature of the first Christian communities was a force to be reckoned with. Despite persecution, the unrelenting truth about God's character, his nature, permeated their lives. They served each other. They took care of each other. They looked out for each other. They served and took care of outsiders in need as well. They weren't always perfect. They got it wrong all the time, just like us. But Christianity at the time was immensely popular amongst the poor and the marginalized in the first to third centuries because Christian communities, churches, were the only places where a rich man and a slave girl could come to a gathering and be treated with the same amount of respect, care, and welcome. Because Jesus said so. And that transformed the world. This way of living revolutionized things. As one person said at the time, these people have turned the world upside down. And this meant that orphanages and hospitals and international aid all had their start with Christian communities. This estranged rabbi who ate at a table and washed people's feet started something absolutely immense. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a little book called Life Together. I recommend it. It's short. It's simple. It'll inspire you. It's not entirely applicable for us in how we experience community together here, because he wrote it living in a sort of underground seminary commune during the years of Nazi Germany. And at one point in the book, he writes this: "The table fellowship of Christians implies obligation. It is our daily bread that we eat, not my own. We share our bread. Thus, we are family bound to one another, not only in the spirit, but also in our whole physical being. The one bread that is given to our fellowship links us together in a firm covenant. No one dares go hungry as long as another has bread. And he who breaks this fellowship of the physical life also breaks the fellowship of the spirit." So Bonhoeffer, like many others before and after him, realized that Christian togetherness is practical, it's physical, it's logistical. It has to be, because it is spiritual. And if we don't continue in this rich and world-changing tradition, if we don't invite, if we aren't relentlessly welcoming, if we aren't kind, if we aren't considerate, if we aren't self-sacrificing, even in the most simple ways, like where we choose to sit and who we ask to sit around us, we aren't Christian. We're all responsible. We're all responsible all the time. It's absolutely what defines us. Last week was Story Sunday, and we heard from a few people. One of the people that we heard from was a girl named Laura. And this community needs to be commended for how Christian it was acting when Laura stumbled upon it. Laura's experience of Christians in church was not a positive one before she experienced life here. She was bullied in school, horrifically bullied in school. She sought solace in church and didn't find it there. She was bullied at her youth ministry. They wrote letters to her, hate letters, and signed their names to it. This was her experience of Christian community. And God, through his grace, had preserved her. And eventually she found her way out here and stumbled upon this community and has been overwhelmed and has allowed her understanding of Christian community to be redefined by how she was welcomed, how she was loved, when nobody knew her at all. This community needs to be commended for stories like Laura's. That's really good stuff, you guys. That's really good stuff. But there's lots more Laura's out there. Not just Laura's that wander into this building or into a life group or into a barbecue that you're having somewhere or into other church events, but there's lots more Laura's wherever we're walking, wherever we are. We don't know their stories, and we'd probably be moved to tears and we'd be moved to action if we did know the story of everyone that walks past us. But it takes taking a risk on people like that and having a welcoming posture as God's posture is welcoming. There is really no action too simple that God won't use. A few years ago, I was at a conference with some pastors and stuff, and there was a woman there who shared a bit of her story, and she had been a pastor for a while, and she really believed that God had used her and done great things through her life, but she decided that it was time for a change and felt that God was calling her to a change. So she quit her job, and she prayed for funds, and God provided for her to be able to move into a house in Commercial Drive in Vancouver. And all she does in this house is practice what she calls radical hospitality. And so that means that she invites anyone to come over to her house really anytime. She runs sort of like a half bed and breakfast, half ministry. It's really, really confusing and quite messy. But she'll have over 100 people a year come and stay for a couple weeks, for a couple days. She is very integrated with the downtown east side and the needs in the sex trade there. And so she's constantly working with these kinds of women and girls. She's got this incredible knack. And so she's talking about what's going on and how she's doing this and what the journey has been like. And she sort of does a little small presentation. A few of us are in the room. And then, I don't know, there's something about what she says that connects with me. And I know we can't all, you know, move to Vancouver and buy a house and do what she's doing. But I was like, there's something about that I feel like I want to learn from. And so I went up to her afterwards and I talked and I said, hey, I'd love to learn more about this. What are you up to? And it was inspiring to me. And she said, yeah, let's do that. So we exchanged email and we'll get together sometime. We all say that about a million times a week, right? We'll get together sometime. Well, this is one of those times where it actually did work. We actually did get together. And she invites me over and says, well, come over to the house and we'll talk and hang out. And so I went over around dinner time. And I walked in and she showed me the house. And it was just her. And there's her roommates aren't around. She's 50 plus. And it was already kind of weird because I'm like, okay, I'm in the house. Maybe we'll talk for a few minutes and kind of go from there. She shows me, she gives me a tour of the house and what's been going on. It's just really inspiring. And then we come into the kitchen. And in the kitchen, she's cooking this incredible, I think it was a chicken or turkey. Like, it was ridiculous. It was huge. And she's cooking potatoes, and she was cooking vegetables, and she was putting a salad together. And there was just so much food. And I kept thinking, oh, I wonder if there's going to be more people that join us for dinner. This is a ridiculous amount of food. And I'm beginning to, like, salivate extremely as a wretched outcast of a bachelor that I am, because meals like these are sort of hard to come by. And so we look at more of the house, and dinner's being cooked, and, you know, we come together, and we finally sit down at a table sort of similar to this one. We sit opposite each other, and the food spreads out, and all of a sudden I realize it's just the two of us. And there's all of this food. There was, like, four meals worth of food. And I'm like, this is kind of awkward and weird. Like, why would she do all of this? It's bizarre. So she says, well, let's pray. So we bow our heads and she begins to pray. And of course, this is one of the times that Luke decides he needs to cry. And it's going to get really awkward now. And you can feel something coming up and you're like, I can't stop it. Here it comes. This is what's gonna happen. It's almost, it's like emotional vomit. Like, it's just gonna, it's happening, right? And you're going, please keep praying longer because I need to get myself under control. And as I'm trying to fight this battle, all of a sudden it clicks. Oh, this is what she does. She overwhelms people with welcome. She overwhelms people with invitation. She overreaches. She makes it almost awkward that she's so gracious and so hospitable in a moment where she's even just ministering to another Christian. What is this like for the person who doesn't know Jesus? What is this like for the woman who walks on the street and is faced with something like this? What is this like for the traveler across Canada, the hippie who's just going out to see what the world's about and stumbles upon this place where, and then they start having conversations about Jesus? What is it like for them? I already know the story. I already understand grace. It was absolutely overwhelming. As I said before, we can't all do what she's doing necessarily, but we can all live with that heart and posture wherever we go, wherever we are, whether it's internally in how we treat each other as Christian brothers and sisters or externally, wherever we are, wherever we go. We're going to receive communion together. And this is just a small, simple picture that we do every now and then on a Sunday. A reminder of a table, a reminder of Jesus' grace, a reminder of his spirit and his love in our lives and in this world. And as we receive communion together, we often have many thoughts going through our minds. But two things I'd love for us to keep in mind and ask and ponder together as we do this. First is ask, Jesus, how much more of your grace do I need to experience? How much bigger do I need to see it? And Jesus, show me areas where I can be as hospitable and as welcoming as you are. Show me those places. Show me those people. Show me those ways.